Coming up on Hear Me Out, chances are you've heard about the Catalyst Content Festival.
Duluth will host ITV Fest, which brings together...
Duluth is set to receive a big national spotlight.
The big announcement for Duluth today, $1.5 million is expected to be pumped into...
But you may not know much about its history in the two Vermont towns where it was located beforehand and why it left. In the second of a two-part series, we'll talk with Executive Director Phil Gilpin about its journey and also hear from others in Vermont and Duluth. Also, do you know who's responsible for one out of every three bites of food you eat? You can thank the pollinators. WPR's Dean Kallenbach talked about beekeeping with April Kustoff, the state apiary inspector for northern Wisconsin, where beekeeping is a popular trend. All that in this week's News and Review after this. Welcome to Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. Do you know what that buzzing sound is? It's one of millions of industrious crews busily pollinating the plants we eat and making honey to go with it. We'll take a look and listen to beekeeping in our part of the state in a conversation with the apiary inspector for northern Wisconsin. But first, our main story. Chances are you've heard about the Catalyst Content Festival coming to Duluth in October as a place for budding TV producers to exhibit their work and maybe pick up a contract from HBO or Netflix.
Duluth will host ITV Fest, which brings together...
Duluth is set to receive a big national spotlight.
The big announcement for Duluth today, $1.5 million is expected to be pumped into...
The event began in Los Angeles in 2006 as the Independent Television Festival, or ITV Fest, and then moved to the small hamlet of Dover, Vermont. There, it was taken over in 2013 by Phil Gilpin Jr., a native of the Boston area who worked for several years behind the scenes at HBO and whose parents run a bed and breakfast in Dover. In that town of less than 2,000 people, Gilpin sought financial support for the fest with the promise of bringing in tourists and their pocketbooks, while also encouraging producers to consider the area as a location for their films and TV shows. The festival was well received, yet the organization posted losses on its tax returns, and when the Dover Select Board granted Gilpin only $35,000 out of his request for $50,000 in 2017, he moved it to Manchester, a town of 4,000 with a history of catering to the rich and famous. There, with renewed support, he declared Manchester the festival's permanent home, but last fall was again searching for another and found Duluth. Last week, we looked at the latest publicly available tax forms for the ITV Fest and found a six-figure deficit for the years 2014, 15, 16, and 17. We spoke with Gilpin about those filings. In response, he called our report unfair for concentrating on the negative and not showing a fuller picture of the fest. This week, we invited him to our studios to have that broader conversation and also to answer further questions. With me in the studio is Phil Gilpin. He's the executive director of Catalyst Stories. Tell me exactly what the title is today.
Yeah, it's Catalyst Content Festival, the event coming up in October.
Okay, and Catalyst Stories is sort of the ongoing manifestation of it, is it not?
Or? Yeah, the Catalyst Story Institute actually is going to launch in January. So I can give you some inside info on what to expect there and what's going on.
Right. And it's previously known as the ITV Fest or Independent Television Festival.
Yes.
Which was begun in Los Angeles, then moved to Dover, Vermont, then to Manchester, Vermont, and here you are in Duluth.
And here we are.
So why don't you give us an overview of exactly where we are?
Yeah. So Catalyst is coming up in October, October 9th through 13th. This will be the 14th year of the event itself. And as I just alluded to, we will be launching our educational and professional development program starting in January. And I'd really just love to, you know, say hi to your listeners out there, and especially to any writers or creators or people who are storytellers, people who have maybe wanted to work in TV and film or any type of podcast or narrative art. And I think the first thing that, you know, we just have to get out there is, I think that what you did last week was really unfair to them. You know, when I heard the piece that you did, it made me think, well, you know, you called me up last week and asked me to trust you, and then that dissipated. But it made me think that, you know, if I'm somebody who is living in Wisconsin or Minnesota and has a dream of telling stories and wanting to be a TV or a film artist, and they hear about Catalyst and they get excited about it, you know, maybe they've heard about it over the last few months, then all of a sudden they heard the way that you edited together that piece last week, the introduction to it would be that this organization is either hiding something or that there's something nefarious going on, and it could dampen that person's enthusiasm who maybe has been really excited about wanting to come out in October. And who knows if they're even going to listen to this follow-up interview. You may have just completely ruined it for somebody. I mean, you made it sound as if we were hiding information that is generally public, and you didn't mention that it's public. You know, things like that I take really seriously, because our organization is large. It's 14 years in. I'm not worried about us, but I'm really concerned about your listener out there who maybe got a little misled by you leading with the negative. And looking at the list of questions that you gave me here right when I just sat down, you know, a lot of this is trying to dig into maybe stuff that potentially could be seen as negative from the past in Vermont, or people who maybe didn't like us there, or things like that. And I can just tell you from the start, I'm never going to speak negative of anybody, especially a place that we've been, and especially a place where I have family. You know, on that front, I just really want to know, kind of my question to you would be, the skepticism with which you opened and which you presented about our organization from the start, I'm really curious to know what's driving that, where that comes from. Is there some type of fear behind either me or the organization? Or I just don't know what it is that, for all the good work our organization does and the good people around here that are working to accomplish all of its goals, all the opportunities that we can give to creators and people, how does the skepticism help them? And I'm being serious, because skepticism is not, you know, something that's only to you. Obviously, an organization moves into a location, you know, and you're not the first skeptic we've met, and we probably won't be the last.
Right.
But to you,
well,
and
in the interest of time, because,
but to you and all the other skeptics listening,
let me answer it.
I'd love to know, how does that help that creator that's sitting out there that maybe now feels a little discouraged?
I hope it helps them by giving them a better and more complete knowledge of the organization, because a few of the questions that we had on last week had been asked in any widespread media. I can't say if they happened in any private forums or not, but I have not heard them addressed in widespread media. Skepticism I will take as a compliment, actually. I'm a journalist, an incurable journalist, for about 30 years, and skepticism sort of goes with the trade. Maybe I'm deluded by taking that as a compliment, but
I don't think it's deluded. I think that there's responsible and then there's irresponsible skepticism, and my belief is that you crossed the line into irresponsible skepticism by leading with it from the start and in terms of the way that you did. And like I said, the big piece is you left out telling your audience that the information, the financial information you were referencing, is public. To me, that was really jarring.
The point there is that it was public, but it was never made public by any of my dear friends in the media. As far as I know, Wisconsin Public Radio is the first one making them public.
A listener tuning in last week and hearing that clip you did would have thought that that information wasn't public and that it was something that maybe we were hiding. And I really would have appreciated had you said, oh, by the way, everybody, just so you know, this is public information. That's all.
Most of it is public information. Some of this I have now from interviews with people, so that's not public. So in the spirit of that, and I do appreciate that, and I thank you, very much thank you for being here. Yeah. And I appreciate the festival, by the way. One thing I can say, if I can give you a pitch, is in all my conversations with people in Vermont, elsewhere, about the festival, even your critics say it was a pretty good festival.
It's a great time. Yeah.
Yeah. So everybody enjoyed the party. Yeah. So I do have a series of questions that you have in front of you there, and we have some exhibits that go with them. And the first question is, and I may refer to it as ITV Fest, because that's what it was called at the time.
Absolutely.
Right? So the ITV Fest board of directors consists of four people, two of whom are married to each other, and it's been unchanged since you took over in 2013. Do you believe this is good practice for a nonprofit that receives public funds?
I'm not going to get into the marriage of people that are that are on the board. But I can tell you that the expansion of the board of directors is underway, and there will be people from Duluth joining very shortly.
Great. Okay. Most of your employees or independent contractors work part-time or mostly in the month or weeks leading up to the event.
Mm-hmm.
You said, and I believe it's two people you employ full-time in Duluth?
Yeah, so when was the last time that you were at one of our meetings that we were talking about the employment? You were at the meeting at OMC over in...
Yeah, I was at the first meeting, and you didn't mention it there, I don't believe.
We've had about 200 events and meetings here in the region since November.
And I did not make them all.
Yeah, no, not expected to. And there's been a lot of changes in that. That's actually one of the really exciting parts is, I don't know if you've caught wind of the production guide project that's been happening, but there's a team of six that have been able to be hired to work on that. And then we have a couple of staff people that are joining the team to help us logistically here in Duluth. So I believe we're up to between 8 to 10 people in Duluth right now that are working on this through October. And then once we get through October, we're going to be launching the educational programming, like I mentioned. So it'll be determined part-time versus full-time coming up after the festival.
So what's the source of their salaries?
It ranges. Some of it's festival money for people that are doing operations for the event. The production guide team, the main sponsors there are the IRRB and St. Louis County Commission. Yeah. So it varies depending on the
So
purpose.
Are those grants that have been made by the IRRB and St. Louis County Commission to Catalyst?
Yeah, they are.
Okay. All right. You said at the very first meeting that you do not take a salary from the festival. Mm. Why not? You do a lot of work.
Right. Oh, it's a great question. When I took over the organization late 2012, we moved it to Vermont 2013, I made the personal decision that for the first few years, I would forego my payments then and put the money back into expanding the organization, because there was a lot of chatter within the industry about, oh, why did they move to Vermont? Why aren't we in LA anymore? So any money that I would have been paying myself those first few years was really better spent growing the organization in Vermont. And when I say growing the organization in Vermont, because I'm sure this will come up again, what I mean is when you look at a festival event like a Sundance or a Tribeca or some of the other major ones that are out there, one of their major expenses is flying in and housing a lot of their speakers and the industry VIPs. So instead of, say, only inviting 20 or 30 industry VIPs out those first few years, I decided to forego my salary so that maybe we could fly out 30 or 40 or 50. And that's that energy that those VIPs create at the event that potentially lead to them buying projects, which gets the headlines that the festival is a place where creators can come and sell their projects. So there was more goodwill intended out of foregoing my salary for those first few years in hopes of attracting more people.
Sure.
Yeah.
So what's the source of your income?
Yeah, so it's pretty fun. It's an event called the Green Mountain Adventure Challenge, is the way when I was living in Vermont. It is like, if you ever played Zelda growing up,
I was a video game
geek myself.
But it's like a scavenger hunt.
It's like a scavenger hunt thing, yeah. So that was my private business while I was in Vermont. And
it's still going on?
It still goes, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's fun.
And your overall company is the Green Mountain Marketing Group?
Yeah, that's the company that does the Adventure Challenge, yeah.
Does it still exist?
It does.
Okay. All right. We are talking to Phil Gilpin of Catalyst Content. I'm Robin Washington. This is Hear Me Out. And if you will bear with me, listeners, we are getting into tax returns. So we have some rather complicated things about line and part and whatever.
Right.
So we're going right into that. We're talking about Catalyst Content under its previous name of ITV Fest. You described to me part of the sources in your 2017 return. It's part X, line 24, and it's described as unsecured notes and loans payable to unrelated third parties. And it totaled in 2017, this is the last year that's publicly available, $262,697. So those are loans. And you call them bank loans. How did you get that without collateral? Because they're unsecured.
Yeah, they were unsecured. So when we were in Vermont, like I referenced earlier, we made the decision that it was better to grow quicker. So when we had the choice of either only bringing in, 50 industry executives versus maybe bringing in 80 or 90, we decided to go out and find partners and people that were really interested in our mission to loan us the money or to donate money so that we could grow the organization that way. And the financial benefit of that is it's very similar to any other business in terms of you invest largely up front, whether it's taking out a mortgage or, buying inventory and things. You have those initial outlays. And obviously the hopes is that the investments you make, you recoup that money and then you make a profit so you can use that profit to keep growing the organization. And in our industry and in our festival in particular, the investment in bringing those people out is that one day there would be a major sponsor that would come out of that group of people. And
I understand that.
That did happen.
The question is the nature of the loans. These are unsecured loans. So how did you get
it's a combination of bank loans and personal loans and, philanthropists and other people. So
okay. Relatives? At one point, I thought you said relatives.
Everybody who's donated or a lot of the philanthropists, they just don't like me to say their names or associations. So that's private information.
All right. When are the notes and loans in this section due?
This is where I wish you had really done more research and not stopped the clock in December 31st, 2017,
sure.
Because this is the second part where it was really discouraging to hear what you did on the story last week, because it made it sound like maybe the organization had some type of, financial problem or something. There's over seven-figure assets on our current balance sheet, but because the fact that you decided, Robin Washington says, I can only go by the 2017 tax returns. There we go. Now it ends. There, you didn't look into what's been happening the last 18 months since then. In terms of when are those notes are due and when are they paid off, almost all of them are already gone, and the ones that are there are there for a reason. And our balance sheet is entirely positive to a very large amount, but that's not something that anybody would have known had they listened to your piece last week.
Okay, but we talk about what's publicly available, and 2017 is the last publicly available. So, you have your 2018 return?
But it doesn't mean the organization stopped working. December
right. So,
31st,
do you have your 2018 return?
Yeah, I believe it'll be filed soon.
Okay. So, all right. In an April 16, 2013 Dover Select Board meeting, the minutes, you projected a $10,000 surplus as you were describing your request to the Select Board, which you said was needed to address cash flow for an enterprise that was going to pay off to the town in the end, which is kind of what you've been describing, is that some of the investments you make early get paid off later.
Correct.
In the end.
Correct, yeah.
You were asked, why then are you asking for a grant rather than a loan? Mm-hmm. And you responded you didn't know a loan was an option. So 6 years later, and you know that now, why are you still asking for grants?
That loan versus grant question was very specific to the town of Dover. And very specific to the way that they had an economic development department, that they were just really starting out in terms of event loans and grants. So that wasn't anything that would carry over to today. It's just the structure of how they decided the town would want to give us money then.
Okay. Also at the Dover Select Board in December 2, 2014, the minutes show that after two of the festivals that happened, you were asked why there was a loss, not the $10,000 surplus as projected for those 2 years, and that it increased, and these are their numbers, not what's actually on the returns, from $80,000 in 2013 to an $85,000 loss in 2014. You responded with a comparison to Sundance and Telluride, and it quotes you as saying, both those festivals have relationships with their sponsor towns. Both of these events rely heavily on sponsorships and experience million-dollar losses. Is that statement truthful?
I actually looked at the Sundance returns from, I believe it was either 2016 or 2017, and their top line just revenue showed $1.5 million loss. And the state of Utah actually recently gave Sundance, I believe, $500,000 grant not too many years ago. So there's an ongoing relationship between those larger festivals and the places that they're in. But that's really for, I'm just going off what's information's public.
Well, this is what was at the time. So I can tell you that Telluride at that time, his 2014 return, said that it took in $7.3 million surplus.
That's about right. Yeah.
Okay, that's not $1 million loss.
Well, that's just 1 year. Again, this is where we're going to get into. It seems like you're just kind of.
Well, if I'm asking you about, what you're going to do with the money, you're asking the public money, and you make a comparison to another organization that's done the same thing, but they happen to have a $7.3 million surplus, and you called it $1 million loss, I think is a fair question.
That was 6 years ago in a different town on a different subject.
Okay. You were sued by your former landlord for your business in Dover for not paying rent after you moved the festival to Manchester. That case was settled out of court 3 years later. How long did you go without paying rent, and how much did you owe?
It's a private situation, and it had less to do with rent than anything else, but I'm not allowed to speak of it.
Okay. Did you not pay rent?
It's a private settled situation. I'm not allowed to speak about it.
Okay. Fair enough.
But I just want to return to the point. This has nothing to do with the festival. This is pretty interesting skepticism. That's all I'm saying. I'm curious now to see where you go.
Okay. In the October 18th, 27 Manchester Journal, you're quoted as saying, "This is the first time in the 12 years of the festival that we've had a full community behind it. This is permanent here. We're as much a Manchester business as Seasons or the bookstore. We're local." Mm-hmm. Less than a year later, you were shopping for a new location. I don't recall that you said when you gave your first presentation where I was that you were actually in Dover. I do remember Manchester well. Mm-hmm. Because I actually shot a television program in Manchester, Vermont. I also shot right next door to Dover in the town of Jamaica, Vermont. So I would have remembered those towns. The Star Tribune at that time was similarly unaware, and they printed, "Gilpin thought he had found the ideal setting when he moved ITV's operations from L.A. to Manchester in 2013. And in fact, that was in 2013, went to Dover, and then 2017, Manchester. Why didn't you tell the people at Duluth that you had previously moved from Dover for the same reason, which was lack of support, that you gave for your move from Manchester?"
We've told hundreds of people about our history many times. You went to one out of 200 events we've had, you said at the beginning.
I haven't seen anything, and again, I'm quoting the Star Tribune here, I haven't seen anything in media saying you were in Dover,
I can't,
except for in Vermont.
I can't pick and choose what the media decides to. I don't write their stories for them.
So given that, and even though I know you have a different take on it, why should the taxpayers of Duluth believe you?
Believe me about what?
Yeah. Believe you that you're here in Duluth to stay. You had previously declared you were in Manchester to mm-hmm. stay. Believe you that the figures will pay off.
Yeah. Then thank you for asking the first fair, interesting question that's actually relevant. The reason that we're really excited about Duluth, and basically the bottom line of all the negative stuff you tried to get into in Vermont, that, like I said at the beginning, I don't like to speak ill about anybody, so I won't, is our organization is growing extremely rapidly in a segment of the industry that is requiring a lot of focus, and that is the independent narrative TV space. When we were in Vermont, we truly thought and were told by the people that were welcoming us there, this is it, this is our home,
In each community.
Feel free to expand and be here year-round, and we're going to support you. We want the arts here. We need young people here. We need new jobs here. And so we thought that we could be a really good partner in contributing to the fabric of the economic growth of those areas. For reasons that still bewilder me and probably always will, as our outside support grew, meaning more people were buying tickets and showing up from outside areas every year, more submissions were coming in, more outside industry sponsors were coming in, for some reason, the local support didn't just stagnate, it actually dropped off. I've been told a lot of reasons for it. A lot of them are not very nice, especially to say on air. And eventually, at some point, we had to decide how much longer are we going to put up the fight. If you're looking to me to answer the question, why did the support in Vermont not match the growth and trajectory that we were on, I'd be doing speculation at best. I don't know what the answer is for that.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here. Phil Gilpin is the executive director of the Catalyst Contents Festival and Catalyst Stories as well. I'm Robin Washington. This is Hear Me Out. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. Many of you know me as both a longtime Twin Ports resident who's also lived in New England, where 30 years ago I produced a TV documentary about Vermont for WGBH in Boston. Among our shooting locations was Manchester, of all places, and Jamaica, Vermont, just outside Dover. I stopped by the area again recently on a side trip when visiting Boston and heard these thoughts on the fest from townspeople.
ITV Fest was good. The first year was great. It was during a time when business was needed. It wasn't during a holiday or anything like that. It was during our low time of season. And then the years after, it was kind of during Columbus Day weekend, so it was still good, but we were already busy, so I don't
know. It's leaf time, isn't it?
Yes. Right. So we were already busy with, you know, customers anyways, so I don't know what the impact was to the Valley, because to me it was just busy. It was just overall busy.
I knew Phil. Phil would come in. We got to see Phil, and very nice gentleman. Fun talking with him. I was saddened that it wasn't going to, because it, you know, it seemed like it was going to keep getting larger, and well, you know, it's how the world goes, and one offered more than the other.
Right. I mean,
and you try it there. Besides, I actually thought it would stick over there.
In Manchester.
Yes. I mean, I've never been there a lot or anything, but to me, I don't know. In my brain, it seemed like it might fit with the type of shopping and different things that are around that area.
We did a private party for a big amount of the IT Fest people, and they're awesome. They're humble. They're great. They're full of character. They're so nice to us, and they brought in a lot of business, for sure. And a continuous, like, consistent every night business while they're here. So you'll see a lot of them, and they definitely like to go and try all the restaurants and all the new things they can in the town.
So the ITV Fest has been here for 2 years, and I think we've always had a healthy relationship with it, and I had hoped it would grow into something bigger than it did. I think that this small community of 4,000 people in the surrounding area supported it the best that they could. But I also think that just the financial resources of a town this small compared to a much larger area like Duluth just proved to be to our disadvantage. So the money that Duluth was able to come up with certainly was much more substantial, $1 million, $2 million of funding, which this area just couldn't compete with.
Those were the voices of Erica Holland of the Valley View Saloon in Dover, located right next door to Gilpin's former office, Lisa Lundy of Herophanalia, also in Dover, Valerie Coulter of Gringo Jack's in Manchester, and Richard Hamm, chief concierge of the Equinox Hotel in Manchester. Randy Capitani of Dover is very familiar with the fest, both as co-publisher of the local Deerfield Valley News and the husband of Vicky Capitani, a Dover Select Board member during the time Gilpin was seeking funds from it. Randy spoke to me from Dover.
We, the Deerfield Valley News, my business, partnered with the ITV Fest for 3 or 4 years to produce the program, produce materials. We, you know, we wrote a number of articles about it, and we were very supportive of the program. We were sorry to see it leave the community. I know it didn't work out. There were some issues that were kind of left unresolved, and I think on top of that, you know, Phil had an opportunity that he saw to move to Manchester, to move to a bigger venue, and so he took that. You know, were we sorry to see it go? I think so. Overall, it was a nice event. Could it have been done better? Were there mistakes that were made by everybody? Probably. You know, so I wish it well. I hope it's successful.
From the numbers that he presented to the select board in town, of which your wife was a member at the time, did it look like it was sustainable?
I would say it was borderline. The consensus was he was looking for money to help both pay off previous year's debt and seed money to get the next year off the ground. And I don't think that's unusual with some of these events. I don't know how accurate of an accounting was ever presented to the town.
And so the final year, he had asked for $50,000 and was granted $35,000.
Yeah, that's my recollection now as we're talking.
But at that time, he was already talking to Manchester?
As we found out, he had been in Manchester giving a pitch, a presentation, the day before. He also gave a presentation to the select board in Dover looking for funding. So he kind of played it off out of both sides of his mouth, for sure.
The festival itself, what was it like?
It was a lot of fun. There was good, interesting, creative talent. A lot of it was, it wasn't mainstream, but it wasn't completely off the wall. It was just undiscovered, and I think that was the whole point of the ITV Fest. These were independent television and film producers or television producers trying to make their way. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed going to see some of the films.
I understand that he changed the dates to Columbus Day weekend.
Yeah, he initially had planned it and had held it for the first few years, maybe the first 3 years, on the weekend after Columbus Day. And the last year, he had had an agreement to hold it that weekend after Columbus Day and then moved it to Columbus Day weekend, ostensibly because he couldn't get some people here. I'm not sure the whole story. But I know that rubbed some of the people in town the wrong way because essentially it violated his agreement. And honestly, Columbus Day weekend is a weekend that takes care of itself in terms of bringing business to the Valley and to Vermont and all of New England. You don't really need another event, and I think that was definitely one of the issues here. All right, Robin.
All right, thanks so much. Randy Capitani spoke to me from Dover. And finally, to better understand errors on tax returns, I spoke with the National Office of the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners and was referred to longtime member Jerry Coplin. I will quickly preface that the word fraud in their title doesn't automatically mean that fraud was committed in any of the materials that they examine.
This is Jerry.
Hey, Jerry. It's Robin Washington.
Gotcha. Loud and clear, sir.
Great. Are there any things in the 990 forms that stand out to you?
Well, I did look at the material that you sent me, and the concerning is that they claim the small organization has policies and procedures regarding ethics and compliance. And from what I understood, there is a possible conflict of interest that a board member, husband and wife, are both associated with this organization. And I didn't see anywhere in the information that you had sent me that that was ever disclosed. So to me, that is a serious issue. If it's disclosed, it can be mitigated, but if it's not disclosed, I just have concerns. It's not necessarily a fraud, but I've got concerns about why has that not been disclosed anywhere.
Mm-hmm. What about the Schedule O that was the same for 4 years running?
Which
he did acknowledge in the first interview I had with him as a typo.
Yeah, obviously, if the Schedule O, if it's identical for 4 years, it's just hard to believe that those numbers are consistent for consecutive years and just doesn't seem to be good business sense to me. I'm not saying he didn't have a show. He did have a show. I think it was probably well attended, but you should have corrected your attendance number, your attendance fees for the second year if you lost money the first year, and then you lost money the second year also. So I just think that that's rather unusual.
Mm-hmm. It's unusual, but doesn't strike me as that major, or is it major from the IRS point of view?
I don't know that it's major, but from a business standpoint, from a business model standpoint, having worked at three major companies for my career, it just seems very bad business. Let's just say that.
Mm-hmm. The next one is the unsecured loans from unrelated third parties. And I asked him if some of those third parties were actually relatives. He declined to answer, said the people wanted to remain anonymous or didn't want the publicity.
Yeah.
I can understand that. But is that what unrelated means, unrelated third parties?
Well, let's put it this way. When people don't answer the questions, from my professional experience, doesn't mean there's a fraud, but when they won't answer the question to me, they did answer the question. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay, right. Well, great. We've been talking to Jerry Coplin. He's a member of the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, which once again does not mean that everything he looks at is a fraud, but he is very knowledgeable when looking at a tax return. Thank you, Jerry.
You're welcome, Robert. Have a great day, sir. And if I can be any of assistance, don't hesitate to call me.
Great. Thank you. So what does this mean for Duluth? Since our conversation with Phil Gilpin on Wednesday, I've received confirmation of two grants to Catalysts made by the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board and St. Louis County. Earlier this spring, the City of Duluth granted Catalysts $50,000 out of its tourism tax money. I spoke with City Councilor Gary Anderson, who voted for the grant.
The financials for ITV Fest, do you recall getting those before the vote was presented or before the package was considered?
No, City Council was not presented those financials, and I didn't seek them out myself. The City of Duluth did, as you report, The city council, with the recommendation of the city administration, is giving the festival $50,000 of tourism tax money. So that's a significant commitment on the part of the city of Duluth for this community. So the numbers are important.
I also spoke with Councillor Jay Fosley, who voted against it.
That's huge losses, and that's not actually why I voted no to it, but that in itself speaks loud words to me.
Both Councillors Anderson and Fosley said the proposal was presented by Mayor Emily Larson. Through a spokeswoman, she declined to come on our show or to answer if she or her staffers had seen ITV's tax returns or if they were aware of his previous tenure in both Manchester and Dover before making their presentation. I'm Robin Washington. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. So who do you think is responsible for one out of every three bites of food you eat? You could thank the pollinators. Beekeeping has become a popular trend in northern Wisconsin, but it comes with challenges. And not just to people like me who've never been stung and are terrified. My WPR colleague in Eau Claire, Dean Kallenbeck, who's a beekeeper himself, spoke with April Kustoff, the state apiary inspector for northern Wisconsin. She discusses the important role beekeepers play in protecting the pollinators. Here's Dean.
So apiary is not a word that we use every day. What's the definition in your mind?
So that is basically your yard where you keep your honeybees.
Very good.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that job. What do you do as a beehive inspector?
So as an inspector, probably the most important role that we play in the state of Wisconsin is that we do quality control inspections for the migratory beekeepers that are moving past our state boundaries, and a lot of people don't realize that. Before the migratory beekeepers are allowed to leave in the fall, they need to have their hives inspected, a percentage of all of their hives. Now we're talking about thousands and thousands of hives, so we can't go through every single one.
But you're sampling.
But we are sampling. Yeah. We're going through, we're taking 10 to 20%. If we see something suspicious, we'll sample more yards. So that is probably the most important thing we're doing to help protect the bees, our native bees here, and also just the honeybees that are being transported around. But on a smaller level, myself or Dan Zeely, we're the two inspectors in the state, and we will go out to people's yards, and we will just do quality control for them. It's a free service that we provide, and we'll just work with you in your hives and just look at how your queen is looking. The queen is very important in the health of a beehive. Look for any pests and diseases that you may or may not be seeing. Help you make a plan. Beekeeping plans are so important. And so when something does come up in your hive, you're not surprised. You're not, you have a plan. You are going to implement either a treatment or some sort of management practice to help keep your hives healthy and going.
Your territory is all of northern Wisconsin, so you get to see a variety of beekeeping in this area.
Yep.
Can you describe the range of beekeeping practices you've observed in this part of the state?
Well, I think most of the differences stem from the fact that we have different climates in Wisconsin. And people don't realize that, but the climate down here is way different than, say, the climate in Bayfield, the climate in Minocqua. And so your practices are going to change related to what are you feeding your bees, how long are you feeding them, when are you putting your pollen patties on, when are you taking them off, when are things blooming in your area. So in that aspect, beekeeping changes based on the climate that you're dealing with and the food that is there. But when it comes to like Faroe mite treatments or some of the other treatments, that's going to be pretty standard across the state. But with the Eau Claire area here specifically, there are a lot of beekeepers in this area. And so you have to be more on the lookout for different diseases and pests that can spread rapidly from hive to hive. Where in northern Wisconsin, you maybe are a little more isolated with your hives, and so you have more freedom in the sense of your hives probably aren't going to be, I hate to use the word contaminated, but things aren't going to be spreading so much from yard to yard.
Nationally, according to Bee Informed Partnerships, the latest survey released last month, U.S. beekeepers lost nearly 40% of their honeybee colonies last winter. That was a record since that organization started surveying beekeepers 13 years ago. Here in western Wisconsin, a survey by the Dunn County Beekeepers Association showed a 70% hive loss over this past winter, And a survey of the Chippewa-Clare County Association members shows that just over half had either no hives or one hive survive the winter. For sure it was a cold winter, but we expect that sort of thing in Wisconsin. April Kustoff, what's killing our bees?
Well, that's a really difficult question to answer just with one answer. But one thing I would say when I go out and I talk to hobbyists or, you know, beekeepers, I tell them you want to prepare your bees for the worst winter, for a fall that ends quickly, for a spring that never comes. And if you do that, you will have a higher rate of success for overwintering. When I hear those numbers, it makes me really sad because I don't think it has to be that way. Mm-hmm. One of the major things that we are dealing with as beekeepers is the varroa mite. And I really encourage people when I come out to yards, we'll do either powdered sugar rolls or alcohol washes to let people know where their varroa mite population is at that time and whether or not they need to be doing management, different management practices, whether it's through a treatment, whether it's through pulling drone comb, making a split where you're splitting your brood, and so you have that brood break. Whatever it is, we really want to keep those varroa mite levels low, because the more we learn about the varroa mite, the more we realize how destructive they really are.
And I understand that there's some new research that gives apiarists and beekeepers a little more insight as to how the varroa mite causes these problems in bees. What is that new information?
Right. So in January, they came out with a published study showing that, so in the past, we have just assumed that the varroa mite was feeding on what we would call bee blood. But what they have discovered, actually, is that the varroa mite is feeding on the fat bodies on the bees. And people say, well, what does it matter? The varroa mite is feeding on the bee one way or the other.
Right.
What matters is that that fat body in that bee is helping the bee stay healthy. It's helping them detoxify. It's helping them deal with pesticide exposure. That fat body built up inside of them helps them get through the winter, so that when there's not protein in the spring in the hive, they can use the fat body in their own bodies to feed their brood. And what we're finding is, so the varroa mite is depleting them of their fat bodies, and so the bees cannot brood up in the springtime. The bees are not healthy enough to make it through the winter. So it's really important that we understand what the varroa mite is after, so that we can help the bees stay healthier to make it through the winter.
Now, last summer, when my wife and I were first-year beekeepers, you came to our home at mm-hmm. our invitation to inspect our
right.
hives.
Yep.
And during that visit, you did a sugar roll, which
okay.
you talked about
yep.
earlier, to help me get an idea of how the hives were doing versus the varroa mites. Can you describe that process? I found it fascinating and kind of odd, but
yeah.
interesting.
So it's, as beekeepers, we have wonderful tools at our disposal to help our bees. And so basically what you're doing is, when you say a powdered sugar roll, that's exactly what you're doing. You're taking a sample of bees and you're rolling them in powdered sugar. And what that does, it coats the bees in the powdered sugar, and they don't like being coated. And so they'll start cleaning that powdered sugar off their bodies. And as they clean that powdered sugar off, the varroa mite actually falls off of them. And so when you shake that powdered sugar out of the jar, you can actually count your mites. So we have a controlled number of bees that we put in the jar. So we want people to sample a half a cup of bees. And if you're finding three varroa mites on that half a cup of bees, we're actually encouraging people to treat. And some people get a little upset. They think that's too aggressive. But what we're finding is, so our treatment threshold is a three mite count. And what we're finding is that when you're already at that five mite count, your hives are starting to collapse. They're already starting to go into decline.
How many bees in a half a cup?
About 300.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, and you can see the wonderful thing, the varroa mites are terrible, but the wonderful thing about them is that you can see them with your eyes.
Right.
And you don't need a microscope. You can see them running around in that sugar. And so it's really easy to count them.
Talk about what the treatment options are at that point then.
So if you do a powdered sugar roll or an alcohol wash, the nice thing I should also say about the powdered sugar roll is it doesn't kill the bees. It just basically coats them in sugar. If you do an alcohol wash, that will kill your bees. But if you're finding a mite count of three, it depends on the time of year. We have different products that are available to beekeepers that they can put on their hives. They work in different temperatures. They, if you have honey supers on your hives, you're limited on what your treatment options are. And so we have different treatments for different times of the year. So as an example, right now, if you were to go out and do a powdered sugar roll on your hives and you roll a three, we would encourage you to use either the Mite Away Quick Strip treatment or the Formic Pro, because both of those treatments are safe to use when you have honey supers on your hives.
Talk about if you're not familiar with the term honey super, what does that mean?
So the honey super is basically the excess honey that the bees are producing that the beekeeper would remove in the fall and harvest for themselves or to sell. So it's basically any box above the brood chamber.
It's interesting to me that a number of beekeepers are attracted to the idea that the bees are natural pollinators and that they produce honey, which has a premium quality when it's local. Yet what you're saying is that chemical treatments are needed to keep our hives alive. Is chemical treatment the only option?
They are not the only option. We also encourage people to pull out drone comb. Drones are the male bees, and we have found that the varroa mite is more attracted to the male bees because they're locked up, I guess you could say, the longest. And so the varroa mite has more opportunity to reproduce with the drones than they would with a worker. And so we encourage people, if you find a frame that's like all drone comb, pull it out. If you have chickens, your chickens will love to eat them. But it's a way that you can pull all the mites that are locked away with the drones. You can pull them out of the hive and remove them. We also encourage people to do, say, a split. You want to do that option, though, more in the springtime. Because you want your bees to have enough time to build up and be strong enough for the fall.
Split, you mean turn one hive into two?
Yep, turn one hive into two. Or if you are just going to requeen a hive, you could take the queen out, wait a little while, so there's a split in the egg lane, and then you could introduce a new queen.
April Kusta, on Friday, the Ideas Network, Kate Archer Kent, during the morning show, interviewed a biologist at Cornell University whose research shows a resurgence of wild honeybees after a steep decline in the mid-1990s. He says the wild bees have better genetics due to natural selection because they haven't been treated with chemicals. So wouldn't evolution eventually develop bees that are able to fend off varroa mites on their own?
That is also a really difficult question to answer. Thank you. My thought process on that is it's going to take a lot of research to defend that train of thought because these, quote, wild bees are splits from hives that have been managed by people. And so I would be curious to know what area he's seeing a buildup of these wild bees. I would be curious to find out how long these bees have been wild. Is it years? Is it a year? There's a lot of factors that go into it. I do see this trend where we are starting to consider these wild bees to be these magic bees that are magically immune to the varroa mite. I have never experienced a bee that is immune to the varroa mite. Now, there are some bees that are more hygienic than others, and those more hygienic bees, that means they're cleaning themselves off more. Until I see the research proving that these bees have become resistant, I'm really skeptical that these wild bees are making it better than managed bees, because dealing with the varroa mite is now basic beekeeping. People talk about, oh, my great-grandfather had bees and he didn't have to put all these treatments on. Well, the varroa mite came over in the 80s. It changed beekeeping forever. And if you're not managing your varroa mite populations, your bees aren't going to make it long term.
What do we know about wild bees in Wisconsin?
Well, wild bees in Wisconsin, it depends
on...
wild honeybees. Yes, we should clarify that in Wisconsin. The thing about it is you won't find them in northern Wisconsin. And maybe I shouldn't make that a blanket claim. But the reality is that managed bees in north, and I'm talking, you know, like north of, like, say, Tomahawk. Now, when you get up by Lake Superior, you do have warmer temperatures up there. But generally speaking, when you're in northern Wisconsin, there just isn't enough time for the bees to build up a large enough population to build up enough stores to make it through the winter. It's just too cold. Managed bees barely can make it through the winter in some areas without either a bee house or some sort of winter preparation for them. And so in southern Wisconsin, you can have these feral colonies that are living in trees or buildings, stuff like that. But in northern Wisconsin, you won't find them.
That was April Kustov speaking with my Wisconsin Public Radio colleague, Dean Kallenbeck, in Eau Claire earlier this week in a segment produced by Clara Neipert. And with me in the studio is Danielle Kading, who will give us the what you call the Week in Review.
Yeah, thanks, Robin.
I like that. Yes, I've been calling the wrap-up roundup and getting all wrapped up in that. So. And you are, I happen to know, a Yellow Jacket alumni of University of Wisconsin-Superior. Did you know about all the bees on campus?
Aside from the alum?
We have about 500,000 bees on campus, and they're under the watchful eye of Dr. Ed Burkett.
I know Dr. Burkett.
Sure, of course you do. So we're really bee city out here. So what about the news? Any bees in the news?
No bees in the news, but I do have a story for you on Asian carp. Great Lakes governors and Canadian premiers have adopted a resolution to prevent the spread of Asian carp into the Great Lakes by taking action at a strategic choke point in Illinois. They will support the state in its role as the non-federal sponsor for the Brandon Road Lock and Dam project. The resolution doesn't specifically mention financial support. The plan recommended by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers could cost as much as $831 million to strengthen defenses at the Lock and Dam. Illinois has voiced concerns over the cost because it would share 35% of the bill. Peter Annan is author of The Great Lakes Water Wars and leads a water center at Northland College in Ashland. Annan says the resolution is a symbolic commitment.
That there's interest in the region to move forward with this lock and dam, which is not going to happen without non-federal dollars, non-federal commitments from the governors and premiers.
The governors and premiers are set to meet in Illinois next week to discuss the Army Corps' plan. The U.S. Forest Service says around 200 people remain at the site where the Rainbow Family held its recent national gathering. Spokeswoman Jennifer Messiah says 30 to 50 people are cleaning up the site to leave no trace of impacts on the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. She says they're taking apart large oven structures as part of the camps, restoring trails, and they'll likely be planting seed. The remaining members of the Rainbow Family are expected to head out in the next couple weeks. The Forest Service estimates anywhere from 5 to 7,000 people took part in the gathering. The Healing Circle Run will begin this weekend. The roughly 800-mile route will run across reservations of 10 tribes in Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Dylan Jennings with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission says the event was organized in response to violent protests of tribal members' rights to spearfish off-reservation in the 1980s.
A lot of our communities really struggled with a lot of the overt racism that was being displayed towards them, and a group of people from, you know, different various tribal communities got together and decided one of the best ways to express ourselves, unite ourselves, is through ceremony and through running or walking.
Runners and walkers will begin and end at the Lac-Courtier Reservation. Jennings says this year the route will include a leg from Fond du Lac to the Mille Lacs Reservation. The Healing Circle Run Walk begins on Saturday.
And thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
That's it for this edition of Hear Me Out. We leave you with Rimsey Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee.